Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00089. Recorded on July 11, 2025. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Texas Red, Part 2. Texas Red, Part 2. Chapter 89.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00088, Texas Red, Part 1.
Where I left off, right? I was talking about John Redcorn's voice actor being murdered down in San Antonio, and in the process of telling that story and giving the background on it, I came up with three different avenues to go down. One of them I have already gone down. And then I added a little bit to that also, right? Spoke about the fact that I have a ex who has a cousin who has a husband who gut shot a burglar in San Antonio, and he bled out on the curb and died in a similar manner to the voice actor who portrayed John Redcorn in King of the Hill, right? And I also moved on and talked about Texas a little bit, how it's changing with the urban sprawl and the economic boom, how it's become very multicultural, and how that becomes problematic. That, coupled with vastly and rapidly improving population, demands more regulation and law, and often in conjunction with that, you start getting Democrats in office. And then all the craziness begins, right? All the cities start turning to hell. The boom that we experience economically starts to turn in and devour us, right? The housing market, the bubble bursts, all that kind of stuff. But then also the corruption down in Austin at the state level in the House of Representatives. You got so many rhinos selling out to the Democrats in exchange for some sort of kickbacks and some kind of prizes, but also seats on certain committees and a certain degree of power, right? Power and influence that comes with that. And they're not representing their constituents anymore. Texas still remains a heavily, heavily red state. You look at the representation in the state government to realize exactly what kind of state Texas is. And by far and wide, conservative Republican, but the way the voting happens in the House of Representatives, you wouldn't think it. You'd think it was just the opposite, because you have false Republicans representing the interests of the Democrats who have corrupted the House of Representatives, because, hey, scumbags being scumbags, right? And that's kind of where I left off. But like I said before, it started off with three avenues to go down. That was avenue number one. Avenue number two is a story I have of a real-life John Redcorn, right? When I lived in Georgia, I mentioned that a little bit earlier in a previous episode. You know, I experienced a culture shock. I did nothing to try to assimilate. I was really a bad import for Georgia, as it was, and I didn't stay long. What was it, a year and a half? A little bit more than a year, like a year and three quarters, just about. Now, in retrospect, I realized just how great a place it was, especially at that time. Better then than it is now. Everything is better then than it is now. But Georgia was really great, and it was actually pretty good to me. But when I was going through it, it didn't seem that way at all. To me, it was, you know, it was like the fourth level of hell. You know, things could be worse, but to me, it was pretty bad. Again, the culture shock and everything like that. But while I was down there, you know, I did what I needed to do to try to maintain my life. You know, part of the maintenance of my life as things were at that time, before I was a saved Christian, right? Before, well, I don't like that word saved, but before I came to Christian, before I came to Jesus, right? Came to faith, all that. The closest thing I had to any kind of spirituality, any spiritual path, any spiritual journey was the 12 steps of AA in conjunction with the fellowship of AA. Which of course is sketchy, you know, that's the fellowship is sketchy. It is what it is. But the program, not bad, not bad. It got me to where I am today, basically. You know, it got me to Jesus, and then my continual pursuit of the truth from that point got me to Holy Orthodoxy, and it just, it is what it is, you know. So the doctrine that I live by, that I'm absorbed with, that I'm steeped in at this point in time, exists, well, not the doctrine, but that condition of my life exists because I started with AA. First I stopped drinking, and then I followed the program of recovery to remain stopped, right? Put the plug in the jug and kept it there. In fact, just yesterday, I might as well say it, 37 years clean and sober, right? 37 years, back from July 10th of 1988. Have not had a drink, have not taken drugs the whole time. A big change in my life, but it wasn't easy, especially in the first 2 years. And, you know, it required a lot of due diligence to wage a war against the devil, because that's exactly what you're doing there. Anyway, so AA was a part of my life, a big part of my life. Not now, not really, not much. I'm thinking about maybe attending a meeting and trying to make that a routine in my week to just make myself useful. You know, I got some use left in me. I have not gotten up and done that. I keep thinking about it, though. But at the time, no. Till I do, it ain't happening. But it used to be a very regular part of my life, daily, you know, daily. Going to meetings and working with others and reading about the steps of recovery, talking about it with people, all that, right? So part of the way on my journey was in Georgia, and I had a home group down there. It was a club. It was club style, which means they ran meetings around the clock every other hour. Really, it was pretty much the only game in town in the part of Georgia where I was at, which was north and a tiny bit west of Atlanta, up in Cherokee County. Not far out, definitely commutable to Atlanta. Out of Atlanta, you take 75 up towards Chattanooga, and there's a smaller freeway that branches off called 575, and you go up that, you know, now you're talking about, well, Woodstock was the name of the town where this particular club was, and it was way out on the west side of it, away from the freeway. And anyway, those details just bog the story down. It doesn't really matter, right? And I don't know. There could be meetings all over the place. And it was so long ago. We were talking about 2006, right, when this is going on. In that meeting, though, there was a guy who was the living image of John Redcorn, no doubt. You know, big, strong, muscular, long, flowing black hair like Native Americans have. Native American, you know, wore shirts with the open chest. Wasn't exactly a six-pack under there like John Redcorn, but he was pretty big and put together, pretty strong, like me. Back then, you know, I still had all my gym equipment. I was working out 6 days out of seven in my garage. I was big and strong, too. And that's part of the situation. That's part of the story. I go into that meeting, right? And part of the custom in a lot of AA groups is you announce yourself. You say who you are, right? That's part of closed meeting protocol, You know, people want to know who you are, and they want to hear you pronounce yourself as an alcoholic, right? It's kind of like a requirement of protocol in closed meetings. And then some groups, in addition to that, will also customarily say what their sobriety date is, right? The last time they drank or the first day they were sober. First day you're sober. It's also known as birthdays, anniversaries. And so you might go around the room and it's like, yeah, my name is Joe. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 1st, 2010. Something like that. A lot of January 1st because of New Year's Eve. Get that last drunk on and, you know, that last DWI. But you don't have to do that stuff, you know. You don't have to do any of it at an open meeting. But at closed meetings, you have to at least say who you are and pronounce yourself as an alcoholic. But you never have to give up your anniversary date. And I decided I wouldn't do that. And there was a reason for it. Because one time before, I had moved out of town away from my, you know, actual New Jersey home group. And I moved up to the northwestern corner of New Jersey in the Mountain Lakes area. A town called Hackettstown, right? Hackettstown, New Jersey. Famous for M&M Mars, right? They make the M&Ms. The M&M factory was a block down and two blocks down from there, from my apartment that I had right on Main Street, right? Main Street is Route 46 in Hackettstown. I took an apartment up there because I had gotten involved with a psycho woman from AA in my hometown. I had to get restraining orders against. It got just really messy and stupid. And I just needed to leave the area. I needed to leave the area and try to make a new start. So when you do that, and you're a recovering alcoholic and you're dependent upon AA and all your fellowship in the world is AA, you walk away from all that. Now you're untethered. Now you're by yourself coping with reality, which is really difficult for recovering alcoholics and non-recovering alcoholics, as the case is. Now, probably for a zillion reasons. Without going down that slippery slope, just say, you know, it's a difficult time and you need your support system, you need your support group. And I had to quickly get reestablished. And I found a meeting that was just like two blocks behind me in the basement of some church, because that's how they do AA up in New Jersey. It's most of it's church basements that you rent out, right? Not the clubhouse thing like I was talking about in Georgia. And in the South, you know, the South, Southeast Texas, it's a lot of clubhouse situations, which is fine. I'm not favoring one way or the other. I'm just telling it like it is. So up there was a church around the block, maybe two blocks back behind me. Walkable, easily, even in the snow and in the cold, walkable, no problem. And I'd go up there, and it was a pretty sizable group. It wasn't huge, and it certainly wasn't small. We did that thing about going around the room. Now, when I first got there, pour a cup of coffee, and I just start schmoozing with people, shooting the shit, you know? And everybody's coming up to me because I'm a new face. See, that's part of AA also, big part of AA. When you're the newcomer, it's very important for people who have been around the block a time or two as a part of their spiritual growth, right? Part of their recovery, to reach out and help the newcomer, right? So when a new person comes in, you usually get swarmed by a lot of people. And it can be overwhelming, right? You get a lot of phone numbers. Somebody will grab you a book that lists out all the meetings in your area, wherever you may be. They'll find a blank page, and everybody writes their phone number down. You get like 50 phone numbers, people to call. Like if your ass is falling off, you have an urge to go out and drink, you know, just call and just keep calling until somebody answers. You know, that was always the way that went. You know, you feel at that moment, besides being overwhelmed, as if you belong, right? There's a real sense of belonging that comes with that moment. And if you stick with it and ride with it and do what you're told, if you use those phone numbers, you start to make connections and you have your own little clique of people that you run with. It becomes your support group, you know, forever and ever. It doesn't go like that for everybody. It doesn't go like that for most people, but the potential is there, right? If you go in and you get sober and stay that way your first try. Now, a lot of people drift off and mess up and have to go through this process over and over. But it's always the same. Even when you've messed up, oh, I was sober for 2 years and I went out drinking, people swarm you again, you know? But you don't get swarmed if everybody knows that you are sober, like, say, 7 years, which is exactly what happened to me in Hackettstown, see? before the meeting started, people were coming up to me, and it was starting to become, then I was starting to get phone numbers, right? I had a list, probably about a dozen phone numbers from people just from hanging around there. But when the meeting starts up and everybody's going around and you know, hi, I'm Joe. Hi, I'm Melissa. Hi, you know, whatever. I'm alcoholic, I'm drug addict, whatever, however people pronounce themselves. And then they would give their sobriety date, and then you do the math in your head. Oh, that guy's sober 6 months. That guy's sober a year. That guy's sober 5 years. On that meeting, there was nobody sober 5 years. In fact, there was barely anybody sober 2 years. It was very similar to how NA was back then, right? Now, back then, we're talking, this is the mid-90s, and before that, NA was still struggling to get its footing, right? That's Narcotics Anonymous. Functions very similarly to Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of people bounce back and forth between the two. I did also, right? I was principally in AA, but I had reasons from time to time to be part of NA also. But NA, still trying to get its footing as an organization, and did not have a whole lot of people that would be clean for more than a year or two before they went back out to the streets, right? From the mid-90s on, that started to change. Now, you started to have people that were 10 years clean and 12 years clean, right? But my experience in Hackettstown was very similar to what I knew at the time, or what my experience was at the time with NA. You had a room full of people that barely had a year or two, right? So when you come, and they were young, right? It was a lot of young people, and they were barely sober. And I come in there, I was young also, but I was 7 years sober. So the meeting starts, and we're going around. You know, this guy's 6 months, this guy's 2 months, this guy's 2 weeks, this guy's maybe a year, this guy's like 10 months, this guy's like 15 months. And that was just the whole thing going around. And it gets to me, and I'm like, well, I got sober in 1988. And you do the math, it's like 7 years. Well, guess what? Nobody had a purpose as a part of their recovery to go swarm me, to reach out to me, to be connected with me, right? The idea is, well, if I'm only a year sober and that guy's 7 years sober, how much can I really help him? I mean, yeah, technically you can help anybody on a given day. But there's that kind of help, but then there's this whole life-changing thing, like where you are a very, like in AA it's called a sponsor. You're basically a mentor to a person, guiding this person through the steps of AA, which is a spiritual recovery process. So you're like a spiritual mentor, a spiritual guide to these people when you become their AA sponsor. Like it or not, that's exactly what it is, because your role, it's basically twofold. You're showing people around, well, really threefold, showing people around AA in a social sense, right? Knowing like who's who and what's what. You're also working towards introducing people like to the institutions around, so you get used to working with other groups and other environments. You might go to hospitals to bring meetings, right? Rehabs, things like that, halfway houses. But the most important part is that spiritual recovery, that guide, that counselor through the steps of the recovery, the 12 steps, right? That's the big deal about AA. I'm getting way off the topic here. I'm telling you a story about a real life John Redcorn, but I'm setting up the deck, I guess. Well, what happened in Hackettstown was people found out I had 7 years and they backed off. They backed off. It was not imperative for them then. They had no obligation to really step up, swarm me, and make me comfortable. They left me to fend for myself, figuring that I could, when really what I needed was as many people as I can be connected with at that time, you know? It was kind of a shit sandwich, and I didn't forget about it. And the whole Hackettstown thing ended up falling apart on me. I ended up back in my area a few months later. When I went down to Georgia, I decided I was not going to let anybody know that I had 17 years when I showed up, because then nobody would talk to me. That's how I felt. Because here's what happens, right? Here's what happens. When you have time like that, you intimidate the other people with time. And what I mean to say is, you got people in a group and everybody's kind of got their pecking order. And you got old timers in the group, right? They have mentored, guided, counseled so many people through the years in that very setting. They have a position of prestige. It's undeniable. And it's well earned, right? So say you got a guy with 21 years and he's 68 years old, you know, and he's done all this work with all these people. Now you come in and you got just a few years less than him, but you're only like 37 years old. You intimidate him two ways. You're close to him in terms of long-term sobriety, right? So you actually start to cut in on his turf, potentially. You become competition for the guy. And you almost can't help it, right? You almost can't help it. This is the way life is. And then on the other hand, you know, that guy still, he may be a bachelor at 68 years old, and he may be using his power influence for attracting women into his life too. Hey, it's AA, that's what I'm talking about. It's a very slippery slope, you know, the fellowship. You know, you need the steps, you need the guidance, you need some kind of camaraderie, but you get a lot of drama and a lot of bullshit. You get a lot of immature-minded people that really just have not lived their life because they spent it pickled most of the time, right? There's a lot of emotional... there's a common theory in AA. It's just a theory, but it's like the years you spent drinking, you did not mature emotionally, right? So you got guys in there who were drinking alcoholically for 20 years and more. They may have started when they were 17. They really never got past being 17 years old, and here they are like pushing 40. See what I'm saying? And it could be even worse than that. Guys could have started drinking when they were 30 and drank for 30 years. Guys could have started drinking when they were 10 and drank for 40 years. They're 50 years old with the emotional presence of a 10-year-old boy or girl. So you get a lot of dramatics that go on interpersonally, and it gets crazy fast. And if you're really sensitive, you could feel this stuff going on, right? If you're intuitive, you could feel this coming off of people, and it can be really bizarre. So you got this competition going on. So I enter a room in Georgia, and it's like that. You've got your old timers in there, and you've got your players in there, and I kind of come in and upset the apple cart, right? The new kid in town, girls want to know who you are, right? Guys are trying to size you up. It's just like that. That's life. You can't help it. And I don't mean to fault it. It just is what it is. It's good to know it going into it. At that point in time, I really didn't know it going into it, right? I just wasn't that wise about the world and people and everything. It was all I can do to just keep my own boat floating. Understanding others so much, not so much. I'm much more better at that now than I was then. But like on those same lines of the competition, this is what I had with the John Redbone guy, right? The John Redbone guy was clearly a player. He drives up, he's got like T-top, black Pontiac Firebird, the rumbling engine. It wasn't a Trans Am, but it was almost a Trans Am, you know what I'm saying. So, you know, it's like the Smokey and the Bandit car. And he drives up. He's got that long flowing Indian hair, you know, blowing out the T-tops. And he's got, you know, 80s metal in the year, you know, 2006. But he's blasting 80s metal. You know, he had shirt open, you know, open-chested shirt. And he's wearing medallions like they did in the 70s. He was a total player, right? He had his game on. He was exactly like John Redcorn, right? He was like 6 foot tall, and he was big, over 200 pounds, just like I was saying before, just like me, you know, the size and everything, a good-looking dude, but a total player, and he disrespected me continually, right, for like a 6-7 month period, something like that. So always found a way to, like, step on me to make himself elevated. Do you know what I'm saying? Because this is how certain people, you know, men, well, women do it too, but men compete with men. And certain ones of them that are immature do that kind of thing, right? They try to shame somebody and then make themselves look taller by making somebody else shorter, that sort of thing. And this guy had a way of doing that with me. You know, player that he was, he had like a couple of cousins, I think, friends or cousins. These were Navajo guys. For whatever reason, they fled Arizona and were living in the Atlanta area. They had their own little thing going on, their own little niche, their own special AA meeting that was a Native American spiritual AA thing, right? Not exactly total typical protocol for AA meetings. It had its little Indian twist to it. I found out about it by some women who were in the home group, you know. They said, oh, they got this spiritual meeting, this Indian stuff they do, and it's really, really cool. You ought to come try it, right? Then I put it off, and I put it off, and then finally one day I said, all right, I'll go down and I'll try it. And I went down there, and as soon as I stepped in the room, I know what I stepped into, right? I was like the last person to get in there. It just worked out that way. It's not usually that way for me, but it was that day. I get in there, and in that room, you had three Indians sitting up in the front of a circle, like at the head of a circle of chairs around, and then in the chairs was all women. It was all women. And I was the only dude that entered into their little special party, right? Their little arrangement. And this is what these Indians had set up, right? They had set up a group where they would sucker women to come in. It's what they did. It's exactly what was going on there. You know, I walked in on it unknowingly, and it didn't go well, you know? It didn't go well the whole time. They were doing all this kind of Indian voodoo kind of stuff with like candles and dream catchers and with the feather, right? The feather was the big deal. They had like an eagle feather or something. And like the guy, John Redbone, leading the group, facilitating the group, he would like hand, you know, he'd get up and he'd hand the feather to somebody, and that person was obligated to speak, you know, to share, as they say in AA and all these 12-step groups, to share their experience, strength, and hope. You know, and so this woman would share, and then he'd hand it to another woman, and she would share. And a couple of women did that, and then he took the feather, and he walked it over to me, and he gave it to me, right? Now, he would handle the feather in a very special manner. He would pass it in a special manner. He made it very prayerful, very solemn. It was kind of hokey to me, right? But he handed me the feather, and I had it, and I'm just like, you know, I laid it down, like on my lap or something, where I was sitting. He's like, no, 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 you must hold it. You must hold it. And he had that voice. You know, the Indians got that deep baritone voice, which is really cool, by the way, right? You know, I wish I spoke like that. But he had that voice. And, you know, I had to hold that feather up while I spoke. And then while I spoke, I was telling a story, you know, a little side story here, about getting pulled over by a cop in Holly Springs, Georgia, which is right down the street from Canton, where I had my house. I was commuting home from work. It sucked. It was a 29-minute as a crow flies drive, and it would take me more than 2 hours to get home. It was close to 2.5 hours most days. And one of the worst spots was just getting there to the last little stretch, right? The road that led to my sub-development, you know, in Holly Springs, it led out. It crossed over that I-575 I'd mentioned before. And then as soon as you crossed over it, my sub-development was on the left. So I was virtually there. I was like within a half mile being home after a miserable 2+ hour commute. And this last part of it is like this T-intersection that backs up a mile, right? Because there's no traffic light on it. There's a stop sign on our end, and the crossing part of the T, they got no stop. They just keep going. And at rush hour, coming out of Atlanta, it's just car after car after car. So it's hard for even one car to turn into this T and join that procession, right? But eventually, you know, 50 cars get let out one at a time. It takes forever. You know, you'd be sitting there 10 minutes, and it feels like another hour. And you're just done. You're just aggravated, right? So the car in front of me at the stop sign pulls out and gets through, and I look and I see the next car coming. There's just enough gap that if I just lay on it, I can get out in front of it, right? So like I was stopped behind the guy in front of me, and when I got to the stop sign, I just rolled right through just because I didn't want to get stuck behind the next 50 cars. Well, the next car coming was a cop, and I looked him right in the eye. I saw he was a cop. I looked him in the eye in a manner of like, hey, idiot, I'm pulling out. You better be ready to hit the brakes if you need to. And I pulled out in front of him, and he hit the brakes, and then he put his lights on and pulled me over because I did not stop at a stop sign. I said, come on, man, you got to be kidding me. I was sitting there stopped for 5 minutes watching everything, and I saw you. I looked at you. Now, I got in an argument with the guy and everything like that, and I called him Barney Fife because who wouldn't, right? And he got pissed. Yeah, wrote me a ticket and everything like that. So now to go pay the ticket, I actually had to take a half a day out of work because the small town, the municipal office was only open certain hours, and all of it was a pain in the ass. And I was pissed off about it, right? I was pissed off about the whole thing. And I said so while I was sharing. It's just one of those things, you know, It had just happened, and it was on my mind, and I spoke about it. And while I spoke about it, I referred to Barney Fife as that damn cop. I said the word damn, and John Redcorn kind of was unhappy. Let's just say he was unhappy, right? I was disrespecting the feather. I was disrespecting the sanctity of the feather, okay? And he said so, and he came to me, and like he was going to take it away. And he warned me, and he said, continue on, but don't use that kind of language anymore. And, you know, I may have said three sentences after that, and damn something else, you know. No F-bombs or anything like that. It wasn't crazy. It was just the adjective, you know. I don't even know that as, like, foul language. It's like the American version of the English bloody, you know, bloody this, bloody that. We say damn this, damn that, damned. Damned, like it's something you would throw on the heap pile at Gehenna. It's damned. What's so foul and vulgar about that? I don't know. I mean, I'm 3 years old on the street. I'd be playing with the kids. I'd come in, your mother, like, where you been? Ah, I was out on the damn street, you know. She, all right, well, wash up for dinner, something like that. Get ready for bed, whatever the case may be. And this guy, again, comes over, takes a feather, explains to me how I violated the sanctity of the holy feather, and you're going to just pass it on to somebody else. And I was just like, I threw it at him. I threw, like a paper airplane. I just threw that, like the fountain pen end of the feather, the quill end of the feather. Hit him right in the chest. And I was just, you know, I got up and I was just like, you know, I'm done with this bullshit, right? Fuck you, I said to him, right? There's my F-bomb for the day here. I get one, right? Sometimes I don't use them, sometimes I use two. On average, I get one, right? I didn't use one that day until that point in time. So that was it. He had been mistreating me all this time in a competitive way because, like I say, he was a player, right? He was a player, and he perceived me as a player. I was young enough in my 30s, but I was also big and strong like him, right? I had a good job. I had my own house, everything like that. Everything, and my truck was brand new at the time, so it was a nice truck. And I was just looking for friends. I was just looking for a support group. He was a player, and he took me as somebody who was going to be competition for him. He did. He did, and he mistreated me for months. That all ended when my, you know, July came around. It was my anniversary date. Somebody was presenting me the medallion. I think it was for my 18 years, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere 17 or 18. So I get up, and now everybody realizes I'm not a newcomer. I'm not even close to being a newcomer. I've been around a real long time, right? And he changed his tune. Now he started to show me the due respect. He literally came up to me after that meeting was over. He said, I had no idea you were sober this long. I mistook you from a newcomer and a whole different kind of person. See that you've been, he was sober for like 4 or 5 years, very respectable in its own right, you know. So, yeah, that's the John Redcorn story. All's well that ends well, I guess you might say. That was the second avenue, you know, the dead voice actor story. The third avenue was the King of the Hill actors, the voice actors had have died since the original King of the Hill went out of production back in 2009, right? So like I said, this John Redcorn guy, who was played by Jonathan Joss, he dead, right? Lou Ann Platter, who was Hank Hill's niece, right? And another key factor in the whole series. You know, every episode there was a Lou Ann thing. The voice actor to play Lou Ann Platter was Brittany Murphy, right? And she died soon after. It's like the same year, maybe a year after, with some very questionable circumstances. I don't really know the whole story. I don't remember it clearly, but something was weird about that. Brittany Murphy died. Lucky Kleinschmidt was Lou Ann Platter's boyfriend / husband or live-in partner, whatever they ended up being. He was played by Tom Petty, the famous rock star, right? Tom Petty died a couple of years back. Dale Gribble, who I mentioned before, the neighbor Hank Hill, childhood friend of Hank Hill, and again, another fixture, you know, main character. He was played by a guy named Johnny Hardwick, who died some time ago. Well, not too long ago. Last year, the year before, not too long ago. Then you start getting into guest stars, right? There was a lot of guest stars throughout that series. Very popular show. a lot of guest stars, and some of the guest stars had recurring parts, right? They were directly related to Hank Hill. For one example, a good example, really two of them I got here. There was a character called Tilly Mae Garrison, which was actually Hank Hill's mother, right? That character. She had a different name because she had a second marriage. But she's literally Hank Hill's mother, and she either did or could have more than one appearance. I don't know if she appeared more than once. I can't say. But she was portrayed by Tammy Wynette, right? Tammy Wynette. Then Hank had a cousin, right? Another relative who could have and maybe did have multiple appearances, right? More than just one guest cameo. And he was played by Dusty Hill from ZZ Top, right? Dusty Hill, who had just died fairly recently. And then there was, of course, another whole bunch of guest stars. Almost every show seemed to have its guest star. I can't say that. That might be a little extreme. Maybe not every show, but a lot of shows had a guest star. You know, I remember Willie Nelson for one. Of course, you don't have a Texas situation comedy animation that doesn't somehow incorporate Willie Nelson into it somewhere along the way over the course of 13, 14 years. It's got to happen. And it was an episode involving his guitar Trigger. Hank had, all of a sudden became a guitar player, had his guitar, and it was around golf and everything like that. But Willie's still alive, somewhere doing something. I don't think he's active anymore. He's very, very old, in his 90s. But, you know, Willie Nelson and then a whole heap of other guest stars that are out there, some of them still alive, most of them still alive, but a bunch of them also have passed on. I'm not going to list them all out now, but that's what happens over time. What really matters for the show is main characters that have gone and relatives, family members that could potentially have been a recurring role, right, at any given time. These are the ones I mentioned, but you could see there's a pretty good amount, right? 1, 2, 3, 4 main characters and then 2 potentially recurring characters in a fairly short amount of time. The show ended in 2009. You know, now you're talking, 16 years ago, and you've lost these people. Now, I guess everybody's replaceable, and it's something that needs to be done in that case. Now, speaking of Hank Hill, right? I keep on talking about Hank Hill and King of the Hill, and well, why not? This is post-Arlen monologics, right? There is a direct correlation between what I'm doing here and what was done there. How do I get into this? Back in the fall, last fall, right? And I could speak about last fall like you don't know anything about it because you don't, because I went like a year without making podcast episodes, and now I'm starting back into it again, right? During that part in time, and I may have mentioned this, my wife and I took a week and we traveled, and we went out to Mississippi and then into the swamps in Louisiana. And while we were like setting up for that, we went through a period in time, not on purpose, not like, oh, we're going to go somewhere, let's watch a bunch of travel videos. I just started watching these travel videos, and I put them up on our big TV, and we'd be sitting there on a Saturday afternoon eating something, and I'd have that on, and my wife would watch, and whatever came on, like, you know, we might put something about when she lived in Mississippi. We might put a video about, like, actually, the way I think it started was we were talking about Katrina, the hurricane, which happened while I was in Georgia with the real-life John Redcorn, right? I was in Georgia when Hurricane Katrina happened. My wife was just north of Gulfport, and it was a nightmare for her and the kids, you know, a terrible time. She's got a phobia about hurricanes now. Of course, ground zero for Katrina, which is mega disaster on exponential levels, was just south of where they were. They were inland, maybe 10 minutes, but the center of the hurricane, the eye of the hurricane, made landfall in, Bay St. Louis, which was just south of them, you know, about 10 minutes as you drive. So the full force of the storm went up, you know, and it was knocking trees out, power was out, you couldn't get water, all that kind of stuff that comes with natural disasters. It was a nightmare, right? So I started watching videos about that. And with YouTube, you know, you just let it roll, and it'll just play the next one, whatever is in its line, whatever the algorithm is to determine what next video, there's usually some kind of relation, right? So it goes from, like, Katrina videos to Gulfport videos and Biloxi videos, and now all of a sudden you're getting into like travel stuff, right? you're going to travel to Biloxi, here's a hotel and casino, and it goes like that. You just watch the next video, then so you start getting into these travel videos, right? And then it goes away from Mississippi and it starts going to like Louisiana, and then Louisiana becomes Texas. You see how just the interconnectivity of everything. And so we would see these videos, and videos about Mississippi, videos about Louisiana. And then there was this one Hispanic couple from Florida that just traveled all about, right? And once you got on to their channel, you don't know where your next video is going to be. It could be them or it could be somebody else. But if it's them, it could be them in Mississippi. It could be them in Florida. It could be them in Texas. And as it happened, this one day it was them in Texas. Where in Texas? They were seeking, right? I don't remember their names. I can't direct you to their channel. It just is what it is. They were looking for Hank Hill's neighborhood. They were looking for the real life Hank Hill's neighborhood. And they did their research online, looking for information about Mike Judge. And I think I've spoken about this sort of thing before. I may have even last episode. But most of King of the Hill takes place. The backdrop is created. You know, they live in a city called Arland, Texas. You put a G in the front, a D at the back, you got Garland. And Mike Judge grew up in Richardson and Garland, near the line between the two. His experience involves that area, and the backdrop of King of the Hill is generally that area. And it just so happens, these people figured that much out, and they go looking for this place, Garland, Texas. They start driving up and down the neighborhoods. They go right into our neighborhood, right? Five houses away, right? We're in the middle of a block, at the end of our block. They were driving up that street, and they were just looking. They were coming from downtown, and they were just looking for houses that looked like Hank Hill's house, neighborhood that looked like Hank Hill's neighborhood. And as soon as they got like two blocks up from us, right? Our neighborhood is houses that were built in the 50s. You go two blocks up from that, the houses start becoming built in the 60s. So they look a little different. Our houses are kind of like bungalows. They're like one-story little bungalows or boxes. They're very small. Then they start getting into small Texas ranch-style houses, right? They're a little bit wider, a little bit spread out side to side. Still one story. Well, that's a Hank Hill house, right? And then we got all the alleys and everything with the privacy fences. So they got two blocks past our street, literally driving down the road, five houses down from us. They found the neighborhood that they thought looked like Hank Hill's neighborhood, and they found the house that they thought was Hank Hill's house, and it was right there in our neighborhood, right? Not on our block, just two blocks behind us, or in front of us, as it is. That's it. So according to them, the official Hank Hill neighborhood is pretty much where we live, right? And now, speaking about that neighborhood, right, the neighborhood, we had the infamous redbud tree, right? I probably have told stories about that in episodes past. I planted my wife and I both worked at it, busted our ass to plant this forest pansy redbud tree, right? Redbud tree. Because the buds are, well, they're not really red. The buds are like this fiery pinkish purple that happens in the springtime, right? The first buds, they bloom out. Gorgeous tree. It's an ornamental tree. It serves no purpose. And I shopped around. I'm looking for the right size, something spectacular that's going to kind of dress up. I had re-landscaped the whole front yard. I'm trying to keep up with the Joneses, and just, you know, every one thing I do, three bad things happen. That's just the way it's been living there. Hard to make anything good out of it, even though I'm very capable. And I kind of got a little bit of a phobia about doing the next right thing, because so many wrong things come back at me every time I try. But we busted our asses. I said we had to bust our ass just to dig a hole to plant this tree. And I bought a 7-foot tree, spent $175 on it, right? Figure give it a couple of years and it'll be an actual tree. They grow fairly rapidly. And it was starting to happen, right? It was starting to happen. But, I had to cut I don't want to get into all the labor of it, because then I'll get negative and I don't even have an F-bomb to spare right now. But it was expense. It was a lot of research. It was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears getting that thing planted. And then after being in the ground for 2 years, last year the leaves on it were starting to get kind of weird, discolored, like there was a disease. And I took the leaves, I took pictures, and I tried to match up online, you know, what's going on with these leaves. And it turned out to be some kind of fungal thing that comes up from the dirt. And once a tree has it, it's terminal, there's nothing you can do about it, right? I just, we just, in that time period, we lost 3 or 4 dogs, right? We lost 4 dogs, maybe in a little bit of a time period prior to the planting of that tree, just in the past few years, right? And we were fertilizing this thing and watering this thing. I would stake it up, I'd restake it up all the time, right? Really wanted this tree to go. And now it's got this terminal fungal disease coming up from the very dirt in the cursed town of Garland, Arlen, and the tree was dying. It was dying, and now I needed to do something about it. It sucked, you know. This spring, when the spring came around, right, all those leaves fell off, and it just looked like a dormant tree like any other dormant tree in the neighborhood. One of the best parts of the early part of spring, right, the uglification season, is the blooms on these redbud trees. There's a whole variety, big and small, but the redbud trees, they're amongst the first things that bloom, and the colors are spectacular, and it's really like the first sign, here comes life again, here comes spring. You know, with that, the birds will be singing and the bees will be buzzing, and the wildflowers start coming up, the grass starts turning green, right? Everything gets groovy, right? And like your first sign of it are these redbud trees all around. This one, you know, that fiery purplish pink color, that real bright electric. Nah, it was kind of like this dopey, uninspired, ordinary purple, like kind of flat. You couldn't even call them blooms. It was like the start of, it was like a bud that went retarded and then kind of bled out a little purplish sort of color. But it wasn't fiery, it wasn't exuberant, it wasn't bright, you know. Wasn't breathtaking at all. It looked sick. It looked sickly. Wasn't dead yet, but I already had it going on in my mind that, you know, that thing has got to be ripped out of the ground and we have to do something else. But the ground's bad. It's not like you just throw another tree in there. It'll get sick too. So I'm like, all right, we'll put a flagpole in, right? Do something like that. But I also went to Jesus about it, right? Because it hurt me. Really, I sat down and had a conversation with my father-in-law who lives across the street. And I was explaining to him, it's like everything I try to do to make this place better, 3 bad things happen. This tree was going to be the beginning of something that just really changes the character of that property. Really, really. It was an ornamental tree. It was supposed to be beautiful. It was the right size. Like I said, I put all this research into it. All this planning went into it. Just for it to get sick from the ground and die. There was no way I was going to, for me to know that that was going to happen. But it did. And now I see that it'll always happen. Because it's from the dirt itself being polluted garbage. That's the city for you, right? City living. Yeah, he just nodded his head. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been living there since the early 60s or something like that. It's his neighborhood. It's his life. I was sad about it. It's the kind of point I'm making, right? I was sad about the whole thing. In the same manner, I'm sad about losing a dog. It's not the same magnitude of sorrow and grief, but it is sorrow and grief nonetheless. So like I said, I went to Jesus with it, and I was like, you know, what do I do? I don't even know what to make out of this stuff. I try to make things better, and things get worse. You know, I try to take a step forward, I get knocked back. What am I to do with this situation? What am I to do with this damn tree, you know? There's that word damn again. She just called this episode the damn episode, right? But I prayed over the tree. Instead of me changing everything, just let's make this tree better. Just make the tree better and give me hope, you know? Give me some hope. Cure the ground so that we can grow things and make the place beautiful. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not about vanity. It's not about, you know, overstepping the neighbors. The whole neighborhood pretty much looks like shit. Nobody's really got their act together, you know? Look, everybody's probably incurring the same kind of difficulties. Why wouldn't they, right? So, I pray it off. I let it at that. I leave it at the foot of the cross, like they say. And less than a week later, the tree starts growing leaves, right? Those blooms fall off, blossoms fall off, whatever. The tree starts growing leaves. And these leaves are healthy. They're huge. They're gorgeous. They're deep red, like burgundy. And they're forest green, right? That's forest pansy red bud. They're two-colored, you know, one on a side. And they're actually red or green depending on season and amount of sunlight and things like that. But whether it's green or it's red, they're both gorgeous colors. And as it's growing, it's mostly red, but it's still got the green. It's beautiful. The limbs just start growing like crazy, right? It's like somebody miracle growed this tree all of a sudden. It came to life. There was no sign of decay, no fungal terminal disease. It looked great. It was everything I was hoping it to be, just not completely grown yet, right? Still only maybe 2 inches in diameter, right? It hasn't, it's still a sapling, but maybe 8-9 feet tall. But branches shooting out of it. You know, last year, I failed to mention that last year in a windstorm, the main trunk of it got snapped near the top, about a foot down. So I lost that much of the tree. And it turns out this damn thing is brittle, but it was beautiful, right? And I say was because, well, another windstorm came. No sooner are my prayers answered and this tree just springs to life and is gorgeous. Then straight line winds come across one night for 1 minute and snapped that thing at the base about 12 inches up, right? First time it snapped it from 12 inches and down, from the top down. Now it's going from the bottom up 12 inches again. Just snapped the whole tree. It was just laying on the ground, done. I shrugged my shoulders. I appealed to God. You know, what do I do about this now? That's a dead tree. I dragged it out to the curb and let the city pick it up, you know? Now I've got this stick 12 inches out of the ground where I was thinking about putting a flagpole. And I just don't know what to do. I'm really sad, very sad now. Now it's a done deal. That tree is completely done. A week later, that thing just starts shooting branches out of the sides like fireworks. And it's got all those leaves again. It's turned itself into a bush. It's alive. It's well. It's thriving. It's crazy. I don't know how it's going to look like in 10 years. Because everything is growing out of its 12-inch tall trunk. But it's growing. And it's growing and it looks great. And we'll just have to see what becomes of it. Maybe I could tie it up and help shape it in time as the branches get bigger. I don't know. But the redwood tree, it's alive and kicking. No sign of any kind of disease in the leaves. It's very strange, very strange. The power of prayer, don't you think? So anyway, speaking about Garland, Texas, right? The neighborhood, Garland, Texas. You know, I mentioned about the connection with the King of the Hill, Arlen. We put a G at the front, a D at the end. You got Garland. I talked about these people, this Hispanic couple that do travel videos going into our neighborhood to identify the Hank Hill house and Hank Hill neighborhood. You know, I talked about John Redcorn, the voice actor for John Redcorn, being shot down in San Antonio. But I was talking about King of the Hill guest stars, and I mentioned about Willie Nelson. You know, I'm talking about Garland and Willie Nelson. Right, this year it was the 50th anniversary of his most popular, most famous album called Redheaded Stranger. Right, 1975, that album was produced and released, and it was produced in Garland, right? There's a studio in Garland where that album was done. It's a very sparse, minimalistic album, didn't really require a whole lot, but it was done right in Garland. And the city of Garland threw a celebration for it over the span of a couple of days in the downtown square. You know, it was basically a Willie Nelson weekend. They did like tribute concerts. All these different musicians would come in and play Willie Nelson songs. And they had like this bus tour that went through Garland, had different stops, and ended up at the studio where it was recorded, right? It was recorded at a place called Autumn Sound Studios, which apparently still exists in some fashion. So yeah, that so the little tribute concerts with all these Willie songs, the studio tour. It was kind of a to-do. You know, my wife and I had nothing to do with it, though, because the kind of people that show up in Garland, well, let's just say it like this. Once upon a time, when you talked like a blue-haired lady, the blue-haired lady used to be a little old lady who was about 85 years old, whose hair was white, silver, and she'd get it dyed, and it would come out blue for some reason, right? Those were the blue hairs. That's what you call the blue hair. But nowadays, in the 2020s, a blue-haired lady is one of these Section 8 psychos on psychiatric medication who's way liberal and on narcotics. They dye their hair blue, and they announce to the world that they have borderline personality disorder, and they like to hang out in blue cities and go to all the events. And we know this because they have some sort of like a flea market thing on the square in Garland, I think every month, and we've gone to it a time or two or three, and that's what you get down there, vendors and customers alike. So it's like you're going to do a Willie Nelson thing. Willie Nelson's all about the bud, man. He's all about the smoking the weed, right? And he's a Democrat, and he jumps in with the globalist liberalism, the Western liberalism, and pontificates his points, and you know that's the side of Willie that kind of blows. But yeah, they did this whole event on that we could have walked to and took part, you know. At another time, maybe 10 years ago, I would have probably done it. But now, there's certain people I just don't want to be around. And look, they don't want me around. I open carry, right? I'll have a .45 in my belt, a knife hanging off of my belt. I'm big, strong. I'm obviously not one of quote unquote them. I'm an offense to them. Wherever I go, I don't need to be that guy. I really don't need to. I'm not enough of a punk anymore to take who I am and just stick it up in your face and make your day suck. No, I'm all about making everybody's life better. I'm not making anybody's life better down there in case some psycho starts popping off rounds and I'm there to defend the innocent, right? But short of that, I create more havoc. I'm mayhem. A mayhem in a liberal environment. So we didn't do it, you know. And I've not really had much to do about Willie Nelson in my life, to be honest with you. There was a time we had the Hurricane Floyd in New Jersey, 1999, which impacted me. I happened to be high and dry, but completely surrounded by the flooding that happened in conjunction with that hurricane. Bound Brook, New Jersey was underwater. But I just happened to live on a high part of it. But I couldn't get out, like, to go to work. And, it just turned out that very weekend there was going to be a Willie Nelson concert in the minor league stadium down the street, right? Which obviously got postponed. That stadium ended up underwater with all kinds of wastewater treatment, sewage. It was a mess, you know. The whole thing sucked. It was a bad thing. I was iffy about the Willie Nelson concert. That wasn't really my cup of tea back then, but it was right there in the neighborhood, so why not, right? So I was thinking about it. I went to the minor league baseball games there a few times a year. Why not? Sparky Lyle, one of my favorite players when I was a kid, was a manager of the team. I got to meet him in the local Applebee's one night. But anyway, way off track, right? That Willie Nelson concert never happened, so it doesn't even matter. I did finally get to see Willie Nelson concert one time, and not even here in Texas, but when I lived in Tennessee. With who? That ex I was talking about, with the San Antonio story, with the guy that got gut shot, you know, the 12-gauge. We were living out in Tennessee, Knoxville area, and we saw Willie in the college, it was the University of Tennessee's college basketball arena, which, what the hell was that called? Thompson Bowling Arena, I think is what it was called, right? And I got to tell you a couple things. First of all, Willie Nelson is not arena music. Willie Nelson is a bar. He's honky-tonk music, right? Maybe a large bar, definitely a small bar, but not an arena. It did not work in an arena. It just did not work. And I left that thinking, well, I've got to see this guy in a better venue someday, but that just has never, even in Texas, it's never happened. My favorite album by Willie is this Redheaded Stranger album, and there's no other album that even compares to it as far as I'm concerned. and not one song from that album was on the set list. Not one. Well, maybe Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, maybe. You would think. I'm not sure. There might have been that one, right? But maybe not even. And then the opening act for Willie was Alison Krauss in Union Station. I don't know if you know her. Alison Krauss has done a lot of duet albums with Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. They were an item at one time. They still do things together. I don't know what their relationship status is, but she comes out of the bluegrass scene, right? You know, one half of country music is bluegrass, comes out of Appalachia. It's Appalachian mountain music. And, you know, a band that she did some work with was Union Station. And they are great. Every single one of them are great bluegrass artists. Alison Krauss is a great entertainer. Funny. She sings like an angel. She plays the fiddle like Charlie Daniels. It's just very, it's incredible. What a great show. Not the best for an arena, but much more better suited to an arena than Willie was, and really was the highlight of the show. Willie should have been opening for them as far as I was concerned, right? Really, Willie shouldn't have been there. None of them belong there. But Alison Krauss and Union Station, they still do work together also. And if you could find them around, I seen they were around here somewhere recently, or they're coming up soon, but they're going to one of those places where I can't carry my gun, right? They wand you at the door for weapons. That's a no maverick zone right there. I would like to take my wife to see that. She would love it. They were very good. So you get the opportunity, and you're not opposed to going to a no maverick zone arena or bar or club or whatever. Go see them. They're really good. Really good.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00090, Texas Red, Part 3.
Thank you for tuning in to Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.